Welcome to the PEAK Podcast for Peace, Education, Arts, and Communication. Today is July 12th, 2018, and my name is Patrick, and I will be your PEAK intern host for today. Today we have a very special speaker with us to speak about his views and experiences regarding a very important current issue, the separation of children from their families in the United States. 2.5 months ago, President Donald Trump and his Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly, publicly confirmed that the administration was considering separating immigrant parents from their children at the border as a way of discouraging illegal immigration into the United States. This news has since sparked massive outrage across the country and the world. The U.S. citizens across the United States have staged protests and rallies to fight against the Trump policy. Even the United Nations took a stance 1 month ago against the U.S. as the UN Human Rights Council called on the U.S. to stop the inhuman separation of families at the border. This issue has attracted much publicity and attention from many human rights experts, and here today we have our very own expert, Dr. Bob Zuber. Dr. Zuber is the president of a human rights-based NGO, Global Action to Prevent War and Armed Conflict. He is a longtime expert at the UN here in New York and has half a century of experience in the field. Dr. Zuber has been an integral part of human rights-related movements at the UN and across the world and is one of the most experienced human rights activists. Recently, Dr. Zuber was at the center of the Mexican border where children were being separated. Today, we are looking forward to hearing Dr. Zuber's experiences at the camps and his thoughts on how people can get involved. We will also be joined today by Lizzie McGowan, who has been featured on other PEAK podcasts. As a knowledgeable and educated graduate student at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, Lizzie is well-versed in many current international issues. We're excited to hear the input from these two experts. So welcome, Bob and Lizzie. Thank you for coming down here to speak with us about your thoughts and experiences.
Welcome to the PEAK podcast, Bob. We are honored to have you here.
I'm honored to be here.
Thanks. Before we dive into this issue, I was wondering if you, Dr. Zuber, could give us a brief background of your experiences in working with human rights issues and why you decided to pursue this field.
Well, I've been at the UN for 17 years in this iteration. And before that, I was a founder of many NGOs. I pastored a church in Harlem during the good old days. And worked for a long time with a Paris-based organization called FIACOT, which works a lot with on torture issues, enforced disappearances, prison conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So I've had a pretty long-standing engagement with human rights. And while I was a graduate student at Columbia, we started something called the International Institutes on Peace Education, and that had a big human rights focus as well.
Clearly, you are very experienced in this field, and we are honored to have you here. So I was wondering if you could give us a short summary of the events leading up to this, to the separation of families by the U.S. government. This is a hot issue right now, and we know you have so much experience, and all your insights are very valuable.
Well, thank you. I don't know. Before I answer that question, I just want to make a point that as of last night, all of us who were involved with this issue received a final draft of the UN Global Compact on Migration, which was brought into being through the leadership of the Swiss and Mexican delegations. It was, like many UN processes, like herding cats, very difficult issue to get to table. There was some real hostility from some delegations about how much the international community should be invested in national jurisdiction issues, like whether or not they will receive migrants and what they do with illegal migrants, et cetera, et cetera. I won't mention the countries that expressed the hostility, but I will say that part of the backdrop of what's going on in the United States now is this growing trend worldwide of closing borders, of putting up barbed wire, of passing laws that that either restrict entry or send people home, in some cases long after they first arrived in the countries of destination. And in the United States, deportation is not new. We've been doing it for quite a while. Separating children is not new. The border issue is a new wrinkle for separation. And there are many people who think that in the U.S., the issue of border separation was actually a political ploy to get Congress to pass a law on migration that the administration wanted them to pass, so that, you know, the notion of children being used, not only taken away from families, but being used as a political pawn, to the extent that that's true, that is a new thing. But deportations have gone on for a long time. Donald Trump did not invent the Border Patrol nor the ICE agents. Children have been separated from families before, often under the guise of you know, illegal immigrants being criminals and thus being unable to properly care for their children. So it was a compelling state interest issue. But, you know, sometimes in the discourse we make it sound as though this issue has been made up over the last couple of months and didn't exist before. And I think we have a longer and somewhat more sordid history when it comes to migrants and the level of acceptance that we give to them.
You're right, Bob. There has been a torrid history concerning immigration in the United States. And in our current political climate, there is more pronounced xenophobia, and coupled with the increasing tide of closing our borders around the world and throughout Europe.
And I think that there's two new wrinkles, and I'll be brief. One is that as one of the women in southern New Mexico said during the rally that took place a couple weekends ago, she reminded the audience that we've been here before, and we've solved these problems before. In the 1970s, Vietnamese were brought here in large numbers after the Vietnam War, and they were brought to places like Oklahoma, which is where I knew them, and places like New Mexico and Texas, places that wouldn't seem hospitable to migrants, very different cultures, languages, climates, and as she said, we made it work. We somehow made that work, and we can make it work again, which was her point to the group. And I think that that's a really important wrinkle, that we've forgotten that we've done this before and that we've made this work before. I think that's extraordinary. And the other wrinkle, I think, is that, which is a concern to me, maybe should be to young people in general. I mean, all of us have to be responsible for two things. One is what we do, and the other is what we permit. And our government leadership now has unleashed genies that we've kept in the bottle for a long period of time, and now they're out and kind of running around. And so it's more okay to be sexist than it was, you know, even 2 years ago. And it's okay to be ethnocentric, and it's okay to have white supremacist leanings and be public about them. And it's okay to harass and attack people that don't look like you. Or like the other day, somebody attacked this woman for wearing a Puerto Rico shirt, as though Puerto Rico is not a part of the U.S. kind of thing, right?
I mean,
and so there's all of this stuff that's going on that we have now been enabled and allowed to say and do that was considered not acceptable in other contexts. And I don't believe in suppressing people, but I do think we've got to figure out a way to get some of these genies back in the bottle and stop releasing them until we figure out how we're going to get them back in the bottle. And for younger people, I think there are many horrifying things that older people have unleashed into your cultural and ethnographic space, and this is one of the worst ones we've unleashed. This is going to be a very, very difficult thing to get back in the bottle.
My grandfather once told me that things don't always change. They have a funny way of remaining the same. And I think I finally understand what he meant. I mean, all these things that we think are fixed just always present themselves differently. Just look at racism. After all these years, somehow there is still a revival of a racist movement. I think this is going to be an issue of our time and something we are going to have to continue to address.
Yeah, and we all got very complacent and I think a little delusional about the pace of change and the possibilities of change. And I mean, you know, bear in mind, we still consume unsustainably. We spend much too much time on our phones. We're suspicious of each other. There are many aspects of our lives that create distance from each other. And getting these genies back in the bottle is going to require more intimacy, not sexuality necessarily, but intimacy, closeness, being willing to take risks with each other and really listen to each other. And the trend lines are not really very optimistic in that regard. So we are not going to be able to kind of abstractly solve these problems by just affirming diversity and our liberal bona fides or whatever those are. I'm not sure what those are, but whatever those are, we're going to do it by reinvesting in each other and cutting each other more slack and being willing to acknowledge what we don't know and figure and find out what we need to know. There's another younger person who you know, Serena, who's around us all the time, and she has we had a very interesting talk about education, and she's very disappointed in school,
yes.
As you've heard her say to you, and the reason she's disappointed in school, I think, is because it's filled her with abstractions that will allow her to make a living, but not with the skills that she needs to make a life. And the skills that she needs to make a life are skills about how to resolve conflict between people, how to get close to people and stay close to them, stay connected. How to live a life of purpose, not a career, in that sense, right? And the distinctions between those, they can be the same thing, but most of us aren't that lucky. So I think that there are many things that we need to learn together that we're not learning in the learning places that have been given to us, and this will be an important issue for you. I mean, I learned more about things that are going on in the border in one weekend in New Mexico than I would learn in a week at the UN and probably a month in school, and including the number of families that had expected their relatives to be with them, and instead of greeting relatives, they're now chasing around the country trying to figure out their whereabouts,
right,
which just strikes me as being a kind of incredible cruelty at some level. Most of what we've done has been organizing other people to do things, not doing them myself or ourselves. We don't have any special dispensation in terms of getting access to people and stuff like that. So most of what we've done is, okay, here's a center. Can we get some social workers who have the credentials, who know what they're doing, to get into those places and ask the right questions and find the children and deal with them. After you've been at the UN, the stuff that you listen to on a daily basis, one of the hardest things about being at the UN is not becoming numb to the things that you hear, right? And when you've been, I mean, I've lived in the Philippines, I've been a lot of time in South Africa, I ran a church in a crack neighborhood, I've counseled hundreds of people in all kinds of really, really difficult circumstances. And there's a point at which all of these things, what they all have in common is that they're human pain that didn't need to happen and that we're not doing enough to prevent. And part of that is because we're distracted. Part of it is because we don't have the infrastructure to deal with it. Part of it is because our values are somewhere other than in our hands where we can touch them and fix them. So we've got a lot of work to do, but I didn't, I found the Vietnamese woman who I described a moment ago to be really, really helpful. And I found some of the family members really, it was really sad. And I found some of the the, you know, Trump is a fascist kind of rhetoric to be really unhelpful. And I think that we all have some responsibility to think really hard about what we would do if somebody called us that, and what our emotional reaction would be. And one of the reactions that it is not is, oh, gee, I must be a horrible person. I think I'll change. No, that's like no one ever says that, right? They say other things. They double down on the thing that you don't like. They want revenge. This kind of rhetoric just doesn't mobilize people, and it doesn't help to heal anything or change anything. And there was really too much of that, I think, at some of the rallies that I went to.
I think the work that you have done is honorable and amazing, but we need more people to get involved, to have open minds and be willing to be proactive in finding out what is actually going on the ground. This is a multifocal problem and one that every global citizen should care about. I think it's extremely important that we present the true situation on the border to our listeners so that they can empathize with their fellow humans and stand up against this terrible human rights atrocity.
Well, Lizzie, I thank you for that. I don't see our work as being all that good, and I think that one of the things that we need to focus on more, I think, is not so much what we're doing, but what's working. And you know, that our job is to move the pile. It's not to do good work so that people will think kindly of us. And I think my generation in general has been a little too impractical in terms of, you know, we've given ourselves too much credit for what we're trying and not beaten ourselves up enough about the lack of impact.
From my brief experience at the UN, I know that you say, quote, old people can clog up the system and make it harder for the youth to have a voice and be effective in change. Speaking from experience, I think it's very hard to find a well-funded platform to be heard as a youth activist. How do you think people should get involved and work with human rights activists?
I mean, one of the things is I'm not a big fan of starting new organizations, but I do believe that you deserve to have your own. I mean, you deserve to have organizations with philosophies and working methods and objectives that are generationally appropriate and that meet the needs of the world as you understand the world. And so some of the organizations, including my own, at some point just need to be put to bed so that room can be made for fresher, newer, more innovative responses to these things, right? But I also will say that you know, again, because my organization is, I mean, I'm the only old person in it, you know, and everybody else is not old, and most of our affiliates in other parts of the world are not old either, you know, so I am sort of the Moses of global action, and everybody else is in it. Well, I'm not as wise as Moses, but the sort of age-wise. You know, in thinking back on my own youth, people my age really took a pounding from older people when we were younger. I mean, they didn't get out of our way either. And there was much less horizontal space than there is now for, you know, I mean, you all get to do a lot of things that you want to do, and you get to spend a lot of time. Some of the things you have to do are maybe not so terribly pleasant, but you get to spend a fair amount of time pursuing your own goals and passions and objectives and trying to figure out who you are and what you're going to do with your life. Those opportunities didn't exist for me or people like me. It was a pretty rough ride there were opportunities, there were jobs that one could go into, but most of those jobs involved working for people who didn't respect us particularly, or, you know, respect our values, our brains, our energy, or any of the rest of it. So I think what you're going through now collectively is something that shouldn't happen, the irony is that in some ways it's better than it was, at least within the realm of the work that I do. The problem is that the times are more urgent. And so, you know, I mean, we had Vietnam. Well, I didn't. I was, but eventually, you know, sort of that era. And we had assassinations, and we had nuclear weapon threats, and all that kind of thing. I still think this is a more urgent time. And so, we have to accommodate the urgency in part by helping you invest your skills and talents in that urgency in whatever way you see fit. You also have educational loans. You also have other things. I didn't have any. I have lots of degrees. I had no loans when I graduated. Well, I worked 40-hour job through graduate school. So I mean, I did it. Yeah, never mind. That's right. And people, especially blue collar people, which I am in my generation, especially in the South, they valued autonomy. And so I would rather eat beans out of a can 7 nights a week than be dependent on somebody. You have a different relationship to dependency, right? You know, you kind of hang in there with that a little more, and you have different lifestyle expectations. I had no lifestyle expectations aside from surviving the day-to-day. And I wasn't poor in any conventional sense of the term poor. So, you know, we have different expectations of life. We have different contexts. We have different excuses that we use for ourselves and the situation that we're in. I think we have a lot more to learn from each other. And, you know, and I adore you folks, as you know. I mean, I think you're just wonderful. And it's been a real blessing to get to spend time around you. I mean, for me. And I have I've had 247 people pass through the office in the 17 years or something. And I'd say well over 200, the word blessing could aptly apply to them. So the notion that there's no important, talented, good people in the pipeline is just simply nonsense. You know, we're not indispensable. It's time we need to back off. As I said to you many times, I've had my turn. You know, it's my turn to invest in your turn. And I think there are more and more people who are kind of realizing that that's the way we have to go.
Well, that concludes our Peak podcast for this episode. Thank you, Bob, for all your words of wisdom.
Well, thank you. I'm out of wisdom, so I'm glad this podcast is concluded. Thanks, everyone. Yeah.
It is always a pleasure to hear all of your experiences and stories. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
That about wraps it up for this weekly episode of the Peak Podcast. Remember to follow our Twitter at Peak Institute, that is PEAC Institute, for live updates on peace-related content from in and around the United Nations. Thank you for tuning in.
I don't have the queen chair, like the queen.